Okay, this morning I'm going to be talking about monk e-business. And the e-business means enlightenment business. So those of you who aren't enlightened yet, please listen to this talk. If you're already enlightened, you don't need to listen, so you can go and have a rest. There's been almost like a progression of the talks over the last few days, from the jhanas to deep insight, and it just seems like appropriate just to continue on from the deep insights to the consequences of deep insights. And even though this may be a long distance in front of you, nevertheless it's worthwhile listening to, because it gets rid of a lot of confusion, it gives you a sense of direction. When you understand what the goal is, then it makes it much easier to understand the direction of your journey. If you don't know what the goal is, then sometimes you can wander around getting very, very confused. And when you know the direction, or rather you know the goal, then you know the direction, then you get some idea of what you're supposed to be doing. And you can also have some idea of your progress on the path. And you see how enlightened you are. Many, many years ago, there was this monk called Ananda Mangala. He was really good fun. He was a great talker, a great speaker. And when somebody asked him, sort of, "Are you enlightened, Venerable?" And he sort of responded with a humorous aside, which had a bit of a meaning to it. He said, "No, I'm not enlightened, I'm not illuminated, but I'm highly eliminated." And the way he said that, "highly eliminated," really stuck with me. And that gives you an idea of what the path of enlightenment is. To see whether you're just not eliminated at all, moderately eliminated, highly eliminated, or totally eliminated. And it gives you an idea of what this is all about. Getting rid of this ego, this self, this me, this mind, which creates the craving, which creates the rebirth and all the suffering which it entails. So actually this is what enlightenment is, but it's best to describe what it is by just how it happens. And this is where we continue on with the journey through jhanas and the deep insights. One of the very powerful teachings of the Buddha, which many monks have noticed and many people have talked about, is just that how this becomes a natural process. This particular sutta is in the Anguttara Nines, and it starts off with this particular sutra is an interesting one. It says someone who keeps precepts, who keeps good sila, is a very virtuous person. They don't need to make a resolution or to decide or enact a will. Oh, may I experience some joy, some happiness. Because it naturally happens that people who are very virtuous are naturally happy. It's a consequence, it's an effect of a cause. And it goes on from that anybody who is got this joy, with a type of happiness, is called pamuja in Pali. It comes from keeping virtue. And anyone who keeps pamuja, they don't need to make a resolution, they don't need to say, oh, what's the next one? Pamuja is it piti sukha or pasadi next? Pasadi and then piti, that's right, yeah. Oh, that when I have such joy, may I experience tranquility. Because it happens naturally that someone who is like happy is usually tranquil. This is a very powerful saying, because sometimes the restless people, why are people restless? Because they're basically unhappy, because they want something else and they're not quite sure what it is, but they want it and they want it now. And this causes restlessness. And this whole movement of people looking for some fulfillment, something, somewhere, and they don't really know quite what. It's called restlessness, and it means a lack of tranquility. But once you have that contentment, the pamuja, the joy, you're happy being here. When you're happy being here, you don't want to go anywhere else. There are some people, when it comes to, when is it Saturday, you won't want to leave. You're just having a nice time here. I don't want to go home. It means you've got tranquility, having a good time, you're at ease, you're resting. When a person's content, they don't want to move. For example, this morning when you woke up, you were very content in your bed. And you didn't want to move. That shows you one degree of prasadya, tranquility. But you can understand that wherever you are happy, you're at ease, you don't want to move. You're having a good time. So it creates this prasadya. But there's two types of prasadya. There is the bodily tranquility and the mental tranquility. And the bodily tranquility comes first of all. That's why that sometimes you see people sitting here so still. And visitors who don't know anything about Buddhist meditation are so impressed. How can a person keep their body so still without moving? It is a very impressive thing to do. Once I went to the travel agent to get a ticket to go overseas somewhere, and the monk with me just sat in a chair. And as I was doing the business with the travel agent, who was really stressed out, she took one look at the monk who was just meditating there. And with great sort of sense of awe and also jealousy, she just said, "Oh, I wish I could do that. Just to be able to sit still and not move the body for a few minutes." But you get that for this inner happiness. You don't have to make a resolution. Oh, may my body stay still. If you've got happiness, it occurs naturally, as many of you are finding. When you get a happy meditation, you can sit for long periods of time, and there's no effort of will required. It's natural. And also that you get what's called a tranquility of the mind as well. When you get some happiness coming up, the mind is so still. It doesn't want to be restless, go thinking about many, many things. As I mentioned earlier, all restlessness comes from a bit of fear, and the fear gives rise to sort of unhappiness, lack of contentment. You don't really want to be here, you want to be somewhere else with your mind. And that means the mind goes all over the place. And as I also mentioned, I think yesterday or the day before, trouble is when you get into timelessness, you haven't got a clue when you said what, and if you said it at all. But I think I said that you have this whole filing cabinet of distractions which you pull out from time to time. Your favourite fantasies, your favourite memories, your favourite plans. And whenever you get bored, you pick them up. And if you can't do that mentally, you do something physically. This is the sign of discontent. The mind is not tranquil. But when you get this beautiful pramuja, this joy, you get not just physical tranquility, but mental tranquility as well. You can just sit there and the mind is still. And the next thing which happens is that you don't have to decide once your mind is still, may I get this inner happiness, the sukha, the beautiful bliss of the mind. It happens naturally. For those of you who are still trying to find the beautiful breath, the more you try and find it, the less you'll discover it, because your wanting is stopping the whole process. This is a natural phenomena, comes from causes and effect. Once your mind is still, the happiness comes of itself. It's a natural thing. It happens. You don't need to make it happen. And for those of you who are in a rush, you've only got 2 days to go, the more you try to make it happen, the less it's likely to happen. So because it's a short time left, you really have to let go now. Shut up, don't do anything, be absolutely still. You have got no more time to waste doing things and wanting things. It's a natural event. Once the mind is still, you get happiness. And this is one of the wonderful insights you get on this path. And if that's the only insight you ever get for years and years and years of meditation or listen to Dhamma talks, that's the one which is probably the most important. From stillness, you get happiness. Because that encourages you to get even more still, get even more happy. More still, more happy, more still, more happy. Until you really get off on the ecstasy of stillness. You don't get ecstasy through a tablet. You get an ecstasy through absolute stillness. And it snowballs. And this is what the Buddha said. It's very clear in the sutta. Once you get stillness, tranquility of body and mind, happiness just comes. If you break that stillness by wanting something, getting excited, getting afraid, or just trying to rush the process along, then you kill it. Just like that old story from my first meditation teacher, who was an ex-monk from Bangkok, and his father gave him some seeds to plant in the garden when he was only about 5 or 6 years old. And he planted those flower seeds in the garden and watered them every morning. And after 1 week, being only 5 or 6 years old, he lost his patience. You know, oh, I've been watering for 5 or 6 days and nothing's happened yet. Just like some of you, you've been meditating for 5 or 6 days when nothing's happened yet. And the father said, never mind, son, because when you put a seed in the ground and it gets moisture, it germinates. There's a little sprout comes up from that seed. And it needs to collect all the nutrients and all of the moisture, and it's pushing up, it's growing, growing, growing. Wait a little time and you'll see the little green shoots above the ground. It's going to happen. The check's in the mail. Meditate a little bit more and a little bit of nimitta will just come up to the surface, pushing its way up there. And this little boy had faith in his father. And so he was patient. He watered the area where the seeds were planted for a few more days. And sure enough, it happened. This tiny little green shoot appeared just above the earth. It was true. Like some of you are patient, and you see this tiny little nimitta come up. Oh, this is nice. But this guy, once the shoots had just gone a couple of inches above the ground, that's when he completely lost his patience. He wanted them to grow quicker, so he stretched them to grow faster. And thereby he killed every one of those plants. And had to start all over again. Just like some of you. You get the nimitta coming up a couple of inches above the mind, and then bang, boom, you stretch it all, make it happen, and you kill every one of those beautiful states. So the point is, you don't do any stretching of your experiences. You don't hurry it along. You don't, come on, only 2 days to go now. Come on, get your act together. Come on, come on, come on. That just kills the whole process. It's a natural process. And what happens next is once you get the happiness in the mind, born of tranquility, this is one of the great teachings. You don't have to make an effort of will. Once you have this joy inside, oh, may I now enter jhanas. Samadhi happens naturally. You don't have to make an effort of will. In fact, you can't make an effort of will. If you try to make an effort of will, it just doesn't happen. It happens as a natural event. He says, dhammata. It is according to cause and effect. That's how it happens. Once you see that, and you've experienced some of these states, you understand just how brilliant and beautiful that teaching is. The Buddha is telling you, please don't let go. It's nature. Allow the whole process to roll. Your job is just the passive observer. And then you get into the interesting stuff. He said, when you have a jhana, when you get into samadhi, you don't need to make an effort of will. Oh, may I see things as they truly are. You don't do vipassana afterwards. You don't say, right now I've done jhanas, now I've got to contemplate anicca, dukkha, anatta, whatever else you want to contemplate. In this teaching, this sutta, it's very clear. The Buddha said, it happens naturally. You see things as they truly are. As a natural course. Maybe one experience of jhana is not enough, but quite a few would usually be enough. He said, once you see things as they truly are, you don't need to make an effort of will to be enlightened. It happens naturally. And the last thing, which is a very beautiful one, once you're enlightened, you don't need an effort of will to say, oh my, I know I'm enlightened. The knowledge of enlightenment happens automatically. I always like mentioning that one, because sometimes people say, you can be enlightened without knowing it. And this is not right. It goes against the Buddha's teachings. Enlightenment is wisdom. It's knowing. It's awakening. How can you be awake and not know you're awake? You can be asleep and not know you're asleep. I grant you that. But you can't be awake and not know you're awake. So the point here is, it's a natural process, a natural course. This is just what happens. So you don't have to decide and control the process. Every bit of controlling is just getting in the way and making it take much longer to happen. So if you really want to waste time and take a long time for enlightenment, try and make it happen. If you want the fast track, just get out of the way and allow the bus to take you to the terminus. So what happens when you get into these jhanas afterwards? You start to see things as they truly are, not as you thought they were, not as you expected they were, not as you hoped they were, not as you, you know, were afraid they might be, but you see them as they truly are. And one of the nice things about seeing things as they truly are, and after you've seen it, you wonder, how the heck could I have been so dim and so dull and so dense not to see this before? It's one of those experiences after a great insight. How could I miss this? Because it's really strange just the way that delusion works. The way that delusion works is once we have a deluded way of looking at life, and like a strange view, then because there's an ego involved in that, it will always actually filter out any perception which doesn't accord to our view. This is in Buddhism, it's called the vipalasas, called the distortions of the cognitive process. And this is an important part of Buddhism, to know that when you have these raw perceptions, feelings, sights, sounds, even sights, people trust in those raw perceptions as if they're somehow pristine and reliable. And that's why in some traditions they say, look, this is the way things are. Just this sight, this hearing, what you're experiencing now, this is the way things are, this is it, this is enlightenment. Just knowing without adding anything onto it. The point is, by the time you cognize something, by the time you feel, by the time you sense, by the time you know something, you've already added a lot and taken away a lot. This is why you cannot trust just raw sensory experience. For example, when you have lunch today, how about closing your eyes and eating your lunch blind? You'll find that the tastes are very different than when you have your eyes open. Simply because when you have your eyes open, you start to see something, ooh, that's nice. And you add what you expect to find onto that food. So it's amazing if you actually close your eyes and then you can eat the most disgusting food and think, oh, that's delicious. And the most of the apparently there are these restaurants. Apparently the theme restaurants where you can go in there, it's absolutely dark. The waiters have night vision goggles, but everyone else has actually no sight at all. And they put these plates of stuff in front of you. You don't know what you're eating, you don't know who's sitting next to you, and you've got to actually find the food. Yeah. They had those in Singapore. Apparently they had them in the West. You know, these dark restaurants. And it's an interesting, I wouldn't mind going to one of those, simply because you'd actually start to find that your idea of what food is, it's not just the taste of food, it's what you see and what you expect creates that taste. What's happening there is your basic perceptions are being bent to suit or fit what you want to see, what you expect to see. Many years ago, I went to a primary school to teach Buddhism, and I didn't know what school I was going to or what class, and when I went there it was grade one. Now this is like 5 or 6 year olds. And how can you, you know, teach jhanas and deep insight, you know, to 5 or 6 year old? So I was really stuck there and wondering, how can I teach these people? And how can I give them some interesting piece of Dhamma? And so the insight came up to me, and I sort of asked all these kids, about three classes, about 80, 90, sort of 5, 6 year olds there. And I said, put your hand up if you don't like rice pudding. Like rice pudding is a sweet which is quite common in Australia. And about 3 or 4 people, kids, put their hand up straight away. They just did not like rice pudding. And you know what happened next? The other children looked around and saw 3 or 4 of the leaders with their hands up. So they put their hands up as well. In the space of about 10 seconds, the whole 90 kids had their hand up. They'd all decided they did not like rice pudding. Put your hands down, kids. Now, please put your hands up if you've ever eaten rice pudding. And those four kids, maybe two or three others, put their hand up. And everyone else laughed. The kids got it, and so did the parents and the teachers. Now there I was showing them the cognitive distortions, the whiplashes. They understood one of the deepest teachings of the Buddha, of how our perceptions are completely conditioned by what we want to see. And even actually fitting in with what we're told to believe. So how many people like sex? Is sex a pleasure? And everyone, this is what you did when you were young. Before you ever had any sex, you put your hand up, yeah, it's a good pleasure. And you got sucked into that ever since. How many people think sex isn't pleasure? Come on, monks, nuns, put your hand up. Now, this really goes against the grain, because it is an assumption throughout the whole of society that having sex is one of the great pleasures of human beings. The Buddha said to Ananda, that is a distortion of your perception. It is no pleasure whatsoever. And that is what we call being radical. You know why it is pleasurable? Because you've been brainwashed and conditioned into viewing it as such. And anything unpleasant in that experience is completely filtered out. Now this is powerful, and this is an extreme example. This is actually the way things truly are. It's fascinating. I don't mind just stirring people up to the max. Now the point is here that you will never accept that. Because next time you have some sex, think, oh, this is pleasure. Of course it appears pleasure, because you've got the view that it is from the very beginning. And that does filter out. And it's wishful thinking, just makes things happen which shouldn't happen. You are creating that world because of your view. This is the trouble with raw perception. Raw perception is completely untrustworthy. Sometimes you may, like food is a very good example, sometimes you may go to someone's house and they may sort of give you a dinner and you don't know what it is, and afterwards they tell you what it is. At the time you really enjoyed it, that was nice. And afterwards, what, you mean snail? I don't like snail. We just had it, and that's really strange. Some of the things which you say you don't like, if they tell you what it is, then you certainly will not like them. If they don't tell you, there's a good chance you might like them. So what is it you like or not like? This is one of the problems with life. The whole of marketing is all trying to force you into liking what they want you to buy. And this is what we do. It is very easy to manipulate people. But you don't realize how much you are being manipulated. How your perceptions are not your own. They've been bent. And this is a problem with seeing things as they truly are. You can't see things as they truly are with an ordinary mind. But if you have the jhana mind, where you're not bending anything at all, then you can see things which are truly shocking. Wow, all this time I thought that sex, I thought that movies, I thought that music, I thought whatever else it is you get off on this world was really fun. The Buddha gave this wonderful simile. He said, like a blind man who sold this cloth by this cloth merchant, who told him it was the most expensive fine white cloth, and it cost a lot of money. He didn't know whether this blind man could afford it, but the blind man said, yeah, I want that, I can afford it. And so this cloth merchant sold him this beautiful white fine cloth, you know, from Benares. Little did the blind man know it was an old dirty rag, but he couldn't see it because he was blind. And then later on a doctor came and cured his sight, and when he cured his sight he looked at that beautiful white cloth and it was an old rag. He said, my goodness, I've been conned. People told me that wearing this patchwork robe was something wonderful and good. And now look at me. Why do you wear the patchwork robe? Have you been sold a dud by me? But we think, oh, it's great, look at my life, patchwork run. It makes you think, doesn't it? But this is what that story in the sutras about this bloke. And it's a very good simile that we are sold a lot of stuff which has no real value because of our culture, of our conditioning. We are brainwashed into liking some stuff which really we shouldn't be liking at all, and hating other stuff which we should be really enjoying. So what happens after jhana experience? Then you have clear vision. It's like giving you eyes. It's like the surgeon restoring your sight. And this is why on the pathway into these deep meditations, you are waking up. Whatever you see is more bright, more clear. So if, wow, I can actually see things now. If you want to hold a train of thought, you can hold it right to its very end. You know, you can actually taste your food. You can actually see the colours in the carpet. The whole idea is of a waking up of the mind, and it reaches its peak in those jhanas, and afterwards the five hindrances which block seeing have been eradicated temporarily. You can actually see things. And that's where you get your deep insights. Not through thinking, because you will just think what you want to think. You'll just perceive in the way which fulfills your views. You'll be completely justifying your position, whatever it is. And to you it always seems that you're justified. Whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Buddhist, whether you're a Hindu, whether you're an atheist, whether you're a neocon, or whether you're a liberal, whether you're whatever you are, or a terrorist, you actually justify your position. You really think that you are doing the right thing. And that's what motivates suicide bombers. They think they're doing the best possible thing for society. To them, they're doing the most compassionate and selfless act they possibly could. And that just shows you how far delusion could go. It's very easy to see how other people are deluded, but can you see how you are deluded? That's a shocking thing. And that's why that after these jhanas, when you really get some insight, you get stunned on how dense you were, how you just could not see it, how you were completely blindfolded. And after that, that's one of the shocks which happens. When you do get the deep insights, and it can be the deep insights into any of these amazing things, such as, like, you know, the constancy of things. Things which were always there, seem to be there, now they're gone, now you know, my goodness, what water was. The water was always in my life, now there's something missing. What the hell was that? You know what things like will is, what mind is. This mind that seems to be always there for you, whenever you wake up, there it is again. Some of it starts to disappear. And that really stuns you. What you thought was always constant in this universe, something stable to stand on, to rely on, is no longer there. Or you see, like, non-self. You know, who is this person who's in charge here? Who is this person who gets worried that they're not succeeding? Or they are succeeding, they get proud. There's no one in there to succeed or fail. It's nothing to do with you. This whole process of life and enlightenment, meditation, it's nothing to do with you whatsoever. It's a natural process. And the sooner you get out of the way, the easier it all becomes. But you can't see that until you get these jhanas. Or like suffering, the law of dukkha. Is life suffering? Sometimes it is, but a lot of the time I'm having a good time. It's very humiliating to admit you're suffering. That's why, like, disease and sickness and old age is one of the most humiliating things for a human being to face. To not realize you're not in control of this body whatsoever, especially when you become incontinent and people have to wipe your backside and you can't even do it for yourself, or you wear nappies again. It's humiliating if you've got ego. You realize it's just what a body does. Nothing wrong, you don't need to feel ashamed of this. Who's ashamed anyway? There's no one in there, it's just body doing body stuff, that's all. But if we don't realize that, we get a lot of pain and suffering. Suffering always comes from the illusion of a self. And the illusion, this is what is said in the suttas by the Buddha, that the enlightened ones, what they say is happiness, most of the world says is suffering. And that's why being a monk, people say it must be so hard being a monk. You can't do what you want, you can't eat what you want, you can't watch movies, you can't have sex, you can't play soccer. And they think, oh, it must be so hard being a monk, just sleeping on the floor and just not being able to do this and not being able to do that. That's why now the female monks are called nuns. None of this, none of that, none of anything else. And this is called the law of suffering. Even listening to Ajahn Brahm's jokes, some people think it's funny, but I'm suffering. So what the enlightened ones say is happiness, the world says is suffering. What the enlightened ones say is suffering, the world says is happiness. In fact, people watch sport and they follow sport, and it's a crazy thing to do. And how many people really get depressed and suffer because their football team or their cricket team or whatever else they support always loses, and it has to lose most of the time. Even in like this Premier League soccer, how many teams are in this Premier League soccer which your husband supports? About, is it 20 or 20-30 teams or something? Say about 24 teams, say. 23 of those teams have to lose every year because only one becomes champion. And so it's like 23-1 chance every year you're going to suffer. And if your team does really, really well and they just get to the final, they get, you know, almost there and they lose, and that's real suffering. So, you know, the odds are against you. They're stacked against you. It's worse than going to a casino. Following sport, you'll never win. You know, maybe once every 24 years if you're lucky. And then just winning it just soon goes. So, but why do people follow this? It's absolutely crazy. If they stood back and watched what they were doing, so what am I doing this for? And this is what an example of what people think is happiness in this world and joy is a lot of suffering. And even some of these like bungee jumping, death drops, and these rides where you go upside down 24 times at great speed. If the American Marines did that to their prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, the Muslims would really go up to get upset. That's called torture. But people actually pay for that. And they volunteer, they queue up in these rides to scare themselves silly. Why do people do that? What people say is happiness in the world. It's a lot of suffering. So actually, when you get really into deep meditation, you can actually see all of this. You've got a perspective. You've come out of the pond and you actually see things in a different way. So what happens is that you've been meditating in these deep meditations. It's a natural course. You start to reflect on what you've experienced. You don't need to decide to do it. It happens naturally. You can't resist it. Eventually it must happen. You reflect upon that and it gives you a completely different way of looking at the world. And something blows. Fuses go. You can't maintain your old positions anymore. And a whole cascade of insights starts to occur. Once you start to see one, they just flow one from the other very fast. You've just broken through the delusion. You started to see the way this whole cognitive process has been deluding you. It's not someone else has been deluding you. It's just the way of thinking. The way that when you have a view that leads to a certain type of perception which is not accurate, it's bent by the view. The view makes you think in a certain way. The perception makes you think in a certain way. And the thoughts reinforce the view. And you get in this cycle of delusion. And once you break that cycle, you start to see things differently. Your mind opens up. How could I not have seen this before? The blind spots get filled in. You start to see what was there. You start to understand what life is all about, who you are, and there's what all these theories really are, where they come from. You don't get knowledge through reading books like Bibles or suttas. You just get the map. That's not really understanding the territory. And that's why when people follow books, they always end up fighting each other. But when you get insights, deep experiences of truth, that's where the fighting stops. Because that's something which is reliable. If it's based on post-jhana, it is reliable, because there you know that the hindrances have been suppressed. If it's any insight which comes prior to jhana, it is untrustworthy. You may be bending the truth, and you just cannot know for sure. So after those jhanas, you get the big insights, the big ones. And I think I described in my little book on enlightenment, which has also just been reworked for the book on meditation, which is coming out soon, that it's like an explosion happens in your perceptual framework. That's why when people get deep insights, they're just going around like people being stunned with a taser gun or something in their brain, because you have to make sure you really, what the heck is going on. Certainly you've seen something, because your old ways of looking, the old frameworks have been dismantled. I don't know much about modern philosophy, but there's, I think they call it the modern philosophy, was it deconstruction? Or what's it called? Any philosophers here? Yeah, deconstruction. But this is deconstruction big time. Because all the old ways, the frameworks for your views, are being completely dismantled. And all the blinkers have been taken off. And you're actually seeing things as they truly are. And that is very hard for a human being, first of all. You realize just how much you depend on certain ways of seeing to actually to relate with the world in which you move and the people with whom you meet. So when deep insight comes, you are stunned and sometimes completely unable to relate for a few days. It's one of the signs of insight. Something deep has happened. You know, you've been blown apart almost. That's why it's great to be able to get those insights on retreats. Because otherwise people think you're crazy, what's going on? Can't relate to you anymore. On a retreat we understand what's going on, so give you time. And this is actually roughly what it's like. You know, like a big explosion happens in your mind. And whenever there's an explosion, there's lots of dust flying everywhere and you can't see clearly. All you need to do is to wait for that dust to settle. And this is what one does after these deep insights. Wait for the dust to settle, to see how many of the old landmarks are remaining and how many are completely destroyed. This is when one starts to understand the Buddha's teachings of the fetters. He said the first three fetters which are destroyed, number one, the self-view. The view that there is someone in here called me who's in control, who can see, who can hear, who's actually here at all. And there's skeptical doubt, not really understanding, you know, what these teachings are. And then lastly is the thinking that you can get to these great insights just through ceremonies, precepts, observances without the deep meditations. Those three hindrances, the first three edifices, are completely destroyed in that first explosion. Sometimes you're lucky that explosion is so strong it destroys other monuments to delusion as well. But those are the first three ones which are destroyed by a stream winner. Sometimes the explosion is very strong, but it doesn't destroy those. Sometimes they're left standing afterwards. You've still got self-view. You've still got to go deeper. More insights, more explosions necessary. Because especially that self-view monument has been there for such a long time, it's buried so deep, it's hard to explode. But sometimes that happens. After the experience, my goodness, there's no one in here. You see that with such certainty, with such depth, it completely overthrows the way you usually look at life and relate to yourself and others. These are big ones. As I mentioned yesterday, whatever you think it's going to be, it's always going to be different than that. The experience is more powerful, more complete, more deep. But if it is those ones, that's called stream winning, entering the stream. You've seen non-self, you've seen the insubstantiality of life, the suffering inherent in all the sense activities. And also, you understand how things can cease. When there's nothing there, then there can be nothing at the end. If there was something there, things can never end. Sometimes people ask me, because they knew I was a scientist before, you have... Now, one of the basic rules of science is the conservation of energy. Sure, the energy can mutate into stuff, into matter, and matter can change into energy, but it can't just suddenly disappear. You can't have something and then nothing afterwards. So how can there be enlightenment? How can there be a cessation? How can something which I know is this suddenly disappear forever? Wouldn't that be ending one of the, or rather in contradiction to one of the fundamental rules of life? The conservation of energy. Sure, that this thing called life can mutate or can merge into some cosmic consciousness, but how can it completely disappear? How can something suddenly become nothing? And that is a good objection. Something can never become nothing. This is one of the problems to people understanding enlightenment. When you talk about enlightenment as a complete cessation and ending of things, that is a hurdle which people have. I just expressed it clearly. When you see there's nothing here even now, that this is empty as I speak, that which you take to be me, a self, will, things, is only an illusion. There is nothing here. When you see there's nothing here now, only then can you understand how nothing is the end of existence. Parinibbana. Now that is a complete different change of perception. The attainment of streamina makes enlightenment possible. It also gives you the understanding of what Nibbana is. You see, as it says in the suttas, the standard expression for all streamwinners is Yankinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Nirodha Dhammanti. This is what they're supposed to have all said, maybe not in those same words, because many would have not known Pali, especially later on in their life, later on in the Buddha's teachings. But what it means is, whatever arises, all of that will cease. Whatever is a thing which comes into being will one day cease. And at last you realize that will comes into being. You can see the arising of will. Therefore, one day it must cease completely. I don't mean just fall away momentarily. Whatever comes into being comes out of nothing. We eventually go back to nothing. The same as mind. There's nothing there. Sometimes people ask, where did mind come from? Where did the first soul get created? And you understand what you're talking about. There is no soul there. So what the question of where did it come from does not make sense. It's just an illusion which keeps on arising in your mind. What arises can one day cease into nothing. When you understand that, you understand the ending of all things. All things. Understanding that, you understand what Nibbana is. Only stream winners can really understand fully what Nibbana is. They've seen Nibbana. That's one of the descriptions of being a stream winner. You've understood the Dhamma. You've seen it at last. Before, you had an inkling of it. You know, you were sort of pointed towards it, but you could never embrace it because it didn't make complete sense. Only when you have the last piece of the jigsaw puzzle, the non-self and things like that, can you really understand what Nibbana is. That's the attainment of stream winner. The definition of a stream winner is someone who has actually seen non-self and seen the ending of things. Once you've seen that, you also understand, it's one of the other functions, you see that this whole process, which you took to be me and important, my five khandhas, my body, my mind, everything which you take to be life, existence, being, you see that now, having seen the illusion, there is no point in continuing that much longer. The whole process is terminally wounded. It's only a matter of time, and at that point the process does become irreversible. Once you're a stream winner, you know you're on the way out and you can't change it now. It is at that point anyone who is an Aryan just knows the confusion about the Bodhisattva ideal. once you are a stream winner, you cannot make any resolution, oh may I put off my enlightenment interminably, indefinitely, so I can help lots and lots and lots of people. It is a physical, mental impossibility. It just cannot be done. You can't stop the process. You're part of this process, and your will is part of the process. Anyone who has seen enlightenment, seen being a stream winner, will know that. And that's why in the early strand of Buddhism, they'd always called it the unenlightened bodhisattva, not even a stream winner yet. But once you see the Dhamma, then there's no way back. You cannot hold. And that's a part of the bodhisattva idea which I really object to. It just cannot be done. It's an impossibility, which you can see. Nice wishful thinking. Nice if it could be done. But it can't, which is why the Buddha sort of got out, left. The most compassionate one. He was a Buddha, left, enlightened, gone. But this is not theory. It's not trying to put down other beliefs. This is insight which comes very clearly from those deep meditative experiences and the types of insight which you get. One of the nice similes which I wrote in the book is a simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors. And this is a simile of the Buddha. It's a metaphor which is very helpful, because when we talk about enlightenment, it's nice to give it some imagery which we can really get a handle on. And this is one of the best imageries invented by the Buddha. Seven shipwrecked sailors goes like this. There were seven shipwrecked sailors. Their ship had gone down. They were stranded in the ocean. The first one went straight down, drowned, gone. The second one floated for a while, and then eventually got tired and just drowned. The third one floated for a long time. The fourth one floated and, floating around, had a look around, and actually, yeah, could see dry land, could see the shore in the distance. The fifth one, having floated and seen dry land, was swimming to dry land, as you would expect you would do. And the sixth shipwrecked sailor, he'd been swimming a long time already, was so close to shore, was actually stopped swimming now, was standing up and just wading through the surf, the final small distance to dry land. And the last shipwrecked sailor had made it to dry land, was sitting under the coconut tree, resting, having a nice coconut. Now, of course, I had many of those extras, but the basic part of that story is the same. And when the Buddha told that story, he said that first one who goes straight down is basically someone who hasn't done much good karma in their life. Basically, in life, you go down. Making good karma, being generous, keeping virtue, looking after temples, Buddhist societies, monks and nuns, whatever, that keeps you afloat. It is true. It's a reasonable thing to do. So the first one, you know, had some faith for a while, was actually, you know, giving donations, looking after everyone, being a good person. But like many people, after a while, they just lose it and they start going down. Which you see that happen sometimes. The inspiration, the good karma only lasts for a while, and they become heedless and lazy, and they go down. The third one, the one who keeps floating, the one who keeps their head above the ups and downs of life, who never really gets flooded or submerged by disappointments like sickness and death, and, you know, your business not going so well, now it does go well, or other disappointments, getting sacked, getting made redundant, or whatever else it is. You keep your head above water all the time. And you know good people do that. Now, if you made lots of good karma, you've hung around Buddhist societies, you're a compassionate, kind, generous person, just some of the things which would really just really upset and swamp people don't swamp you. You know, you're a floater. Now, once you are a floater, it's only a matter of time when you look around and see the land. It's over there. You come to retreats like this and people tell you how to see. You know, do a little bit of jhana and then bam, oh, there it is. You see nibbana. That is the experience of stream winning. The shipwrecked sailor, they've floated and they've seen dry land. They've seen the freedom from suffering, the end, the purpose, the meaning. Now, once you are a stream winner, it's natural, it has to happen. You start swimming to the shore. If you say, no, I'm not going to swim to the shore, I'm going to stay here for all the other shipwrecked sailors. No shipwrecked sailor does that. They may actually tell a few people on the way, this is the way to go. That's fine. But they don't really wait too long, otherwise they too will drown. They start swimming. And that is called a once returner. They're on the way to shore. And you get so close that you're standing up in the surf. You don't need to swim anymore. You can feel the dry ground underneath you, the safety underneath you. We're still in the surf. You just got to wait those last few meters to dry land. And that is the non-returner, the anagami. Now, somebody was asking me the other day about anagamis in the interviews. And just to show you what an anagami is, we've got all these descriptions of anagamis in the texts. Some of the old ones. First of all, there's the Gatikara, the potter. Now, he was an anagami. He was a lay person, not a monk, not a nun, a layman. But this is what's required of you if you want to be an anagami. Not only did he have no wife, no sex, because he just couldn't, that was just beyond him. But he wouldn't even harm a living creature to gather his clay to make his pots. He would wait until some rabbit has dug out a burrow, or some rats had dug out some earth, or the lay people making their paddy fields had some little earth left over. He would not dig the earth himself in case he might injure the small creature. So that's just how sensitive the anagami is to the welfare of other beings. Number two, when he made his pots, he would not sell them. He'd put them on the bench outside his hut and say, if you want a pot, go and take one. If you want to leave a donation, take. Leave some rice or lentils for me. Now that actually really is amazing, because not even monks do that. Sometimes they charge for their teachings. They don't say, take whatever dhamma you want. If you want to leave a donation, that's fine, but that's completely separate. You can see here the beauty of what a monk is supposed to be aspiring towards. Not charging for things. And this is one of the nice things about the purity of our tradition. Whatever we do for no charge at all. Here in Perth recently, I've done a number of funerals, mostly for Westerners. And the Westerner said, is there any charge? He said, no, there's no charge. You can leave a donation if you like. Oh, that's amazing. That's wonderful. Thank you very much. But no donation. Well, that's fine, because it's done for free. You don't charge for anything. Actually, for this retreat we charged, didn't we? But that's nothing for me, that's just for this place over here. And actually, that's what I say, that when we build our retreat centre, now our one, not this one, it'll all be for free. So we just leave the donation box over. You can come and meditate as long as you like. If you want to leave a donation afterwards for its upkeep, pay the debts, fine. And that's real Buddhist. That's like, you know, what you see from an anagami. Someone who's actually hasn't got any like personal wants. But the best one is this woman who was an anagami at the time of the Buddha, and the king's soldiers came to her small hut and arrested her son. He was accused of doing some crime which he was actually innocent of. They got the wrong person, but they executed her son right in front of her. And she said, it was amazing, it was wonderful, that I didn't feel any emotion, no anger, nothing at all, that my mind was even throughout. Now you understand what detachment is. A mother's love for her child. And there, the mother was seeing life in such a different way than an ordinary person. So that's a great test of whether you're an anagami or not. Where someone can get your child and execute them for nothing, for the wrong reason, right in front of your eyes. Now that's a powerful statement, but it gives you an idea of just how profound these states of enlightenment truly are. So if someone goes along there and says, it's not fair, it's not right, someone called me a pig, They can't be an anagami or not even a screamer or anything. They get upset at small things like that. And they get angry at anything. Because the anger is something which disappears when one becomes an anagami. No anger, no lust. And one of the other beautiful things which is said of the enlightened one, the one who swam to shore, is that they don't hoard up possessions just like householders do. And that's another great way you can actually test out your teachers to see how much they're hoarding. That's why I say whenever there's a katina or entry to the rains, they go into our monastery and look inside the monks' rooms. See what they are hoarding. Then you get a good chance to see actually just how they're practicing. And maybe any other temples you support or monasteries, wherever you go, ask to see the abbot's room. Then you can get a good idea of what's going on. Because one of my most inspiring teachings from Ajahn Chah was after many years as a monk, I was sitting under his hut and he asked me to go up to his room and get something for him. And you weren't usually allowed into his room. About 8 years or something I've been there since I could go into his room. And of course, as soon as I was sent out, I couldn't wait to see what's he got in his room. What's he really like? Because it's not that hard to actually just sit up and give inspiring talks, or to, you know, to play as being an enlightened person. But now he was actually letting me into his private quarters, and I opened the door, and it's amazing. One of the most inspiring examples. Inspiring moments of my monastic life to see his room there, even though he was a famous monk and people were giving him all sorts of things, prime ministers, princesses, big businessmen. This was the height of his fame. And in his room there was the straw mat, a wooden pillow, one robe, and that was it. There's a book there somewhere, and that was it. It would have taken him about 1 minute to pack up all his possessions and go somewhere. All his possessions. How long would it take you to pack up your possessions and move house or go anywhere? Even just moving your suitcases to come here just for 9 days. That took him a time. Now that was a sign of a great monk. He didn't have anything, nothing, and it was just so inspiring. It was like a person that I committed myself to this teacher for such a long time, and it inspired you with his behaviour, with his talks, with his meditation practice, just like the icing on the cake. This was like a real thing, and when you actually see that, it just really inspires you. Yeah, it is still possible in this world to be like that. There are real monks, real nuns around who don't have many possessions, who just really get into enlightenment, who are really detached. Isn't that wonderful? That was probably the best teaching I ever received from Ajahn Chah. At least one of the best anyway. He gave me many other really powerful ones. And this is actually what enlightenment really is. And actually, just that brings to mind the other really great teaching I got from Ajahn Chah, which I always like to, it's a great one to finish off with. Again, this was maybe the last year of his life, of his teaching life, rather. I call it his life because when he was sick, couldn't speak anymore, it's almost like he was dead anyway. Certainly his teaching life was dead, his body was still alive. But at this time, he started to complain about like dizzy spells. He started getting sick. And we were Western monks, we were just in this little monastery, it was only within 6 kilometres from his monastery, walking distance. We used to walk over there very often and back again. Now, I wanted to know how to cut across the fields and through the villages. And on this, because we were Western monks, we got this idea, you know, to build a sauna. Because we read in the ancient Buddhist texts, in the early monasteries, they used to have saunas. That was allowed as one of the monastic buildings, you know, about 26 centuries ago. So those saunas actually never originated in Sweden. They were very much there in 26 centuries ago in India. So we decided we'll build a sauna because it was traditional. We read about this, and it may help our teacher's health. He may get a bit better. And sure enough, when we built it, Ajahn Chah would come over once a week to take his sauna. But that, I must admit, wasn't the only reason, or maybe not even the main reason. You know, we weren't really so concerned with that. Well, we were concerned with Ajahn Chah's health. I've got to be honest about this. But we were also concerned with getting our great teacher to our monastery once a week. Because it's very, very famous, very busy, and that was actually the trick to get him to come. Have his sauna, because he would come there in the afternoon, and obviously we'd all come out to meet him, and he'd give us a Dharma discourse, give us some teachings, and then he'd go off and have his sauna, and people would help him at the sauna, and he'd give out a few personal little bits of instructions, nice little words here and there, which really meant a lot to you, with your teacher, and then he'd go back again. You wouldn't see him for another week. So it's a great trick to get our teacher to come to the monastery. On this one occasion that he came for his sauna, and he gave the talk in the hall, first of all, and it was a great talk. Every now and again, it just really hit you. And if ever you've heard a really good talk, you get so inspired, and you just want to get somewhere and sit meditation and just carry on from where you left off in the talk. So this occasion, that's what I decided to do. There's lots of other monks, and I've been helping Ajahn Chah a lot, so you know, you guys can go and help him. I went around the back of the hall and sat meditation. And this beautiful meditation, which you do get when you're inspired. So peaceful and so nice. I don't know how long it was. It wasn't that long, because when I opened my eyes, you know, I thought there was still a chance to go and see my teacher and help him out at the sauna. So off I went to see if I could help do some services for Ajahn Chah. And as I was going towards the sauna, he was coming back. He finished his sauna, and he was walking in the opposite direction with two Thai people, going to his car to take him back to Wat Pa Phong Monastery. So we crossed on the path, and before we crossed he stopped and he looked at me. Now some of these great monks, they can look right through you, and you know that they're checking you out. He obviously saw I'd had a deep meditation, and he checked me thoroughly, only in a second or two, and he looked at me and said, "Bong Wang Sir."
"Why?"
That's what he said only in Thai. It was "Bong Wang Sir, come on." And sometimes when someone actually, it's like being stabbed by a sharp sword, goes right inside you. I realized afterwards he was trying to enlighten me. He saw I had a deep meditation, see if like the power to go to the words of another could really get me. Why? But I was only 7 or 8 years as a monk, didn't really know much about anything, and I said, "I don't know." I mentioned that story in the Zen conference, and everyone started clapping because they believe in the don't know mind. I said, "No, that's not the end of the story, shut up." Remember that? And Ajahn Chah sort of smiled at my stupidity and started laughing. He would never criticize you when you're doing something stupid. You would just think it incredibly funny. We gave him lots of reasons to laugh, because we were so stupid sometimes. So he just laughed, and then he pulled his face together again, and obviously being serious again. And so, you know, I sort of stopped laughing as well, and he looked at me and said, "I'll tell you the answer, because if anyone ever asks you again, this is the answer to the question, why?" And of course I was all ears now, really listening. He said, "The answer to the question why is, there is nothing in time, my me or I. That's the answer to the question why. There's nothing." He looked at me again, "Pama Wang Sir, do you understand?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "No, you don't." "Do you understand?" "No, you don't." So that's one of the wonderful teachings of Ajahn Chah. But it shows you the emptiness, no self, and there isn't anything. Once you understand that, you understand cessation. There's nothing left. That's the answer to the question why. But you can only see that after deep meditation. So this is what enlightenment is all about. This is what's going to happen. Don't think, "Maybe I don't want to become enlightened." Now you've heard that. maybe I just don't want to disappear. Maybe not this lifetime. I want to enjoy myself a little bit more. I'll maybe put it off till maybe when I'm old and then I get enlightened. I'll enjoy myself, have lots of sex, watch all my movies, finish off the Star Wars movies, and then afterwards, then I'll become enlightened. Unfortunately, as with your meditation, it does not follow your schedule. It happens when it happens, so that you are not involved in this at all. So unfortunately, as I said, you're on the bus, and so when the bus gets to the terminus, it gets to the terminus. It doesn't matter about what you think, it's too early, too late, too fast, too slow. So shut up, let go, enjoy the ride. This is what's going to happen. That's the talk on enlightenment. Okay, so are there any questions about the talk? Because I noticed on the list over there that many people have crossed their names off the interview list because they're probably already enlightened, got jhanas already, so they don't need interviews. But the people who were on there was still left. There was Suli, Sue Tomlins, Pauline, and Adeline. So when we do have the interviews, just you four, that's all there is. So just one after the other. So forget about the times you put your name down there. So we got plenty of time if anyone wants to ask a question. Yeah? You don't want to interview? Okay, just sweet, got more time for questions. Anyone else want a question? Yeah, go on, John. Well, they don't offer food and money. They don't offer food because they hold money. Lay people are just so generous. When Ajahn Sumedho and a couple of monks first went to England, he was talking with Ajahn Chah. He said, "Well, look, I'm not sure if you were going to feed us." And Ajahn Chah responded and said, "Aren't there any kind people in England?" And so they said, "Yeah, sure, there's kind people in England. Then people will feed you." And you know, some of the monks, even now, our monks go on arms rounded, Armadale in serpentine, and they get heaps of food. Some of the monks went on Tudong, which is just walkabout, without any money, without any attendance, in Ireland, Southern Ireland, a Catholic country. And they got fed. Recently, early this year, a couple of Ajahn Pasano's monks went on walkabout on Tudong in Louisiana, Alabama. And yeah, you've got, oh, this is real tough country. And they still got fed. You know, even in born again Baptist country. It's amazing just when you have that degree of faith, then maybe you don't need money. Maybe it's a lack of faith. Because people, if you're a good monk or a good nun, they'll always look after you. Now this a Japanese monk in our tradition, Ajahn Kawesaka, and he's a really good friend because he was ordained just a few months after me, so we sat next together for a long time. Because whoever you ordain with, that's your friend or your enemy for life. It soon becomes your friend because you've got to sit next to them, you soon get it together. So he was one of my mates, and I think after 6 years or whatever, he decided to go visit his family in Japan, in the north of Japan. So he's a really good monk. So what he did, he got his plane ticket to go to Narita Airport, but his father was a poor farmer way up north. He didn't have anybody to meet him at the airport. So he just, when he got to the airport, he just started walking north. That night, wherever he got to, I think it was somewhere in the middle of Tokyo, he just found a park and put up his mosquito net and slept there like a monk, and went on arms round in the morning. No one knew who he was, but he did have the advantage he could speak Japanese, being a Japanese monk. And so soon, sort of, people asked him, "You know, who are you? What are you doing? Never seen this before. I'm a Buddhist monk. This is what we do." And they were so impressed. I think within a day or two, the TV cameras came out. With another day or two, So the Thai ambassador, who was recently the Thai ambassador to Australia, found him. And he was looked after so well throughout the rest of his visit. Because people were inspired. At last, there's a real monk has come to our land. A monk who doesn't need an attendant, who works completely on faith. Doesn't mind going without food for a couple of days. You don't die, you can sleep anywhere. And that was really impressive. So, on arms round, he got an ambassador in his bowl. And a few lots of other people as well. So it's wonderful actually to go back to sort of some beautiful traditions. But even actually some, and this is Theravada monks, they may not receive any money, but they've got bank accounts in their own name. And some of them are very, very wealthy. And that seems to me is wrong. Even if you don't touch the money, still having it stored, you know, for you, by somebody else, seems to be really wrong. So I really go against sort of monks having personal bank accounts. You're supposed to be a monk, have nothing, and just rely upon, you know, your good karma for your next meal. I've been doing that for a long time, and look how fat I am. So it works. So does that answer your question, John? I think it can do. I think if it doesn't matter what monk you are, Mahayana, Tibetan or whatever, and if you really were if you really did give up your money and possessions, people would look after you just as well as they look after me, or even better. Any other comments, questions? Yeah, you got one.
Sometimes sometimes people ask, is it wrong to give those kind of monks money? Or could, you know, like people have a lot of faith and they want to give, but then they get into this doubt, like, can I give them money or can I not?
That's a tough one sometimes, because it's probably the best is actually to ask that monk what he needs, or the nun, what do you need? So instead of giving them money, which is something you want, let me know and I'll buy that for you instead of giving you the money. That's usually the best. And if they say they've got some project in the monastery, oh, give me the monastery's bank account number and I can send it to your monastery rather than to you. If you need money because you've got to get some food, what do you want, sir? I can get you some food. What do you want to eat? So it's best actually to look after the needs of the monk rather than giving them the money. If you possibly can, that's what you should advise. That's even the Thai people who are here today. If you see a Thai monk coming from overseas, Tami Kon Thai Ma Mayim Prat Thai, you know, Hai Tawai Ngan, Kaja Tawai, like, Bai Pawarana, Gadigwa. Because that way you're helping the monks keep their rules. Is that okay, John? Any other question? No, your question. Any other questions there? Go on. Wow, it's a big question. How did you come up with that one after talking about enlightenment? Okay, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that's going to really survive all that longer, because it's usually that we can go backwards whenever we feel threatened. But, you know, that's only temporarily. We have to come out and engage with the world eventually. And especially, like, you know, there's always the rebellious youth in all the countries. And the rebellious youth, I saw an article about something happening in Saudi Arabia, where all, I think about 50% of the population in Saudi Arabia is under 23 or something. So they've got a huge youth population. It's becoming very restive. Now, they like rap music. I like to see the latest movies, and apparently they go in their cars, I think, to Bahrain or something, where they can actually see movies they can never see. Not Bahrain, where is it? But anyway, somewhere very close by. but in another country, so they can see movies, because they're not allowed to see movies in Saudi Arabia. So when that starts to happen, you realize it's like a rebellious youth. And usually the rebellious youth start to change things over. But give it time, because, you know, time and education, one of the nice things with things like internet and satellite TV, it's very hard actually to control people's access to information. I know they see more information, they probably see that there must be a moderation of that Islam, and an openness, especially an openness to criticism. Just like Buddhism is always open to criticism, or any religious person should be the hardest to offend. Not the first to offend, but the hardest to offend. You know, we've got compassion, we've got wisdom. So, of all the people in the world, you know, at the moment, it's sometimes politicians are very hard to offend because they're such hard skin. People call them all sorts of things, especially in the Australian press or the British press. And they've got this tough skin, and sometimes, why can't religious leaders have an even tougher skin? They're supposed to be spiritual. Why do we always shout offence? Ah, you're offending my religion, you're offending my faith. So, religion shouldn't get into that at all. Anyway, I think that's enough on the enlightenment of politics, or politics of enlightenment, whatever it is. So now is the time to do some meditation, so that you can put into practice the answer to the question, why? Because there's nothing there. So see if you can go to the great nothing, the great void between your ears. When your teacher said to you, there's nothing in there, is there? You should have said, yes, you're right. So enjoy the next few hours or whatever it is until lunchtime, and see how much you can't do, not how much you can do. See how close you can get to being highly eliminated.